Today is Thursday, October the 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on the government of Ethiopia to allow its UN representatives continue their work in the country. And U.S. President Joe Biden says a change to Senate filibuster rules is a real possibility to raise the nation's debt limit.
We're going to lead the world like we used to. If we're going to do that, we have to also invest in our people.
In the Philippines, election season has officially kicked off with thousands of candidates vying for national and local positions. And in Afghanistan, humanitarian aid organizations are calling attention to the plight of millions in the country as winter approaches.
They are not now getting aid because the aid pipeline has been cut.
We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. And for our top story, President Joe Biden traveled to Michigan Tuesday to promote his legislative priorities on infrastructure and social spending. The two bills face a stalemate in Congress as members of Biden's own Democratic Party wrangle over the size and scope of the package. VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widakswara has this report.
Investing in infrastructure and expanding social welfare programs are two key issues President Joe Biden campaigned on. With his legislative agenda stalled in Congress, he visited a worker training facility Tuesday in Howell, Michigan, to promote his plans.
It isn't enough just to invest in our physical infrastructure. We're going to lead the world like we used to. If we're going to do that, we have to also invest in our people, like you do right here in training this training facility.
Biden pushed key legislative agendas, the $1.2 trillion infrastructure package that has bipartisan support, and the $3.5 trillion Build Back Better plan. It's championed by progressives to fund what they call human infrastructure, including education and climate change mitigation.
They don't increase the debt because they're paid for by asking the very wealthy to begin their pay their fair share. As a matter of fact, a significant portion of this plan cuts taxes for working people. And best of all, the cost of these bills in terms of adding to the deficit is zero.
The plans are stuck as lawmakers in Biden's own party disagree on its size and scope. Democratic centrist Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona say the $3.5 trillion package is too expensive and they want it trimmed. Meanwhile, progressives in the House of Representatives threatened to withdraw support for the $1.2 trillion infrastructure proposal unless the larger bill passes. Since the Senate is split 50-50, Democrats cannot afford to lose a single vote. Jason Grumet is the president of the Bipartisan Policy Center.
If those two things fail, the administration's going to have not a whole lot to show for its first year. And it also really calls into question, you know, kind of the core premise of the Biden presidency, which is focused, pragmatic, calm, legislative expert who can get things done. You know, if all of a sudden the Democratic Party spins out of control under his leadership, it really calls that kind of fundamental idea into question.
Biden visited lawmakers in Congress last week, but failed to get them to agree, despite popular support for some of the bill's components. Not only would it address the nation's crumbling infrastructure, but the bill would also provide for universal pre-kindergarten, lower-cost child care, and paid family leave. Again, Bipartisan Policy Center's Jason Grumet.
The pandemic revealed a lot of the frailties in the U.S. economy, and the legislation is now addressing some of those. You know, there's also been a significant focus on climate change in both of these pieces of legislation, which obviously matters a lot to the global community.
Biden's Michigan visit reflects the importance of securing moderate support by the October 31st vote deadline. The legislative deadline for Biden is October 18th, by which date Congress must vote to increase the debt ceiling to avoid potential global economic turbulence caused by the U.S. defaulting on its debt. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
And President Biden is enlisting top business leaders in the bid to push Congress into immediately suspending the federal debt limit. AP's Saga Meghani has more.
With the nation another day closer to an unprecedented federal government default, a move by Democrats to change the Senate's filibuster rules appears to be on the table. Previously resistant to such a maneuver, President Joe Biden told reporters Tuesday evening,
"Oh, I think that's a real possibility."
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's frustration was evident earlier in the day.
"If Republicans would just get out of the damn way, we could get this all done."
But Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell again pointed out the Democrats are in control.
"They need to do this. They have the time to do it. And the sooner they get about it, the better."
Doing away with the filibuster rule would lower the threshold for passage from 60 votes to 50. Mike Gracia, Washington.
With the pandemic eviction moratorium now expired, the Biden administration is trying to provide some help for public housing residents who have fallen behind. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
The Department of Housing and Urban Development is setting a new rule. Those in subsidized public housing would have to get 30 days notice of eviction and be steered toward federal emergency rental assistance programs. They can help with back rent and buy some time for those having trouble. A department official who spoke anonymously in advance of a formal announcement says there's significant concern about a looming wave of evictions as cases that began when the moratorium lifted make their way through the courts. It's estimated the changes could help about 4 million at-risk renters. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
And Pope Francis is expressing shame at the scale of clergy abuse in France. AP's Walter Ratliff has more.
Pope Francis has expressed shame for himself and the Roman Catholic Church for the scale of child sexual abuse within the church in France. The Pope spoke about a report that estimated some 330,000 French children were abused by clergy and other church authority figures dating back to 1950. He expressed sadness and pain for the trauma that they suffered, and shame over the incapacity of the church to put the abused at the center of its concerns. He called on all bishops and religious superiors to take all actions necessary so similar dramas are not repeated. I'm Walter Ratliff.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The head of European Union's foreign policy, Josep Borrell, warns that Afghanistan is facing a breakdown of its economic and social systems and risks turning into a humanitarian catastrophe unless much-needed aid is sent to the country. Reports say that since the Taliban took power in August, food prices in the country have jumped more than 50%, and the capital, Kabul, could lose access to electricity as the winter sets in because the country's new Taliban rulers haven't paid electricity suppliers. The UN and other international humanitarian agencies like the Norwegian Refugee Council are also calling attention to the dire situation in the country. In the second part of our conversation with Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, I ask him if he's worried that this will soon be a forgotten crisis.
Not really, because Afghanistan will be on the minds of so many. The NATO countries have their fingerprints all over in Afghanistan now for 20 years. So I think, I know that the Western capitals would not want to see mass starvation, epidemic disease, collapse in water and sanitation and so on. In Afghanistan, they know that it's the same good people who are living there that they were supporting for so long, but they are afraid to in any way sustain or go through the new Taliban authorities. So the answer to that is establish trust funds within the UN. UN agencies are there with us, the non-governmental organizations, and the World Bank money can go through them directly to teachers and nurses and others without touching the new political authorities.
Now, aside from Afghanistan, what would you say is currently one of the biggest humanitarian crises in the world that is perhaps not covered as much?
Well, I would say the neglected crises are overwhelmingly now in Africa. I was earlier this year in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where millions suffer basically without much attention. Cameroon is in a deep crisis many places for countless people. In the Sahel, there are enormous challenges, and we feel overwhelmed and overstretched and underfunded in many of these places.
Mm. And, you know, finally, Jan, how do you get someone in America or in Norway, in Sweden, a regular citizen who is going about their life, their business, who's going through, you know, a tough time in this pandemic to care about these issues?
Well, I think we get very decent people all over the world to care for fellow human beings by saying it is possible to help. It is possible to help people help themselves. It is possible to reach those in great need in Afghanistan. It is possible to educate both girls and boys in Afghanistan. My organization are on the ground. We're doing girls' education as we speak in Afghanistan with female teachers and with female aid workers. We're not giving up. We cannot give up. So people need to help us in the toughest corners of the planet. That's basic civilization, and it is the same in all major religions, in all major philosophies. We have to help those in greatest need.
That was Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council.
Voice of America!
And the investigation into last year's massive explosion in Beirut has been slow, due to what observers say is interference by the powerful Iran-backed Hezbollah group. Lebanese judge Tarek Bitar has survived two removal attempts. The latest was on Monday when a court dismissed complaints against him. But Hezbollah continues to threaten him and the probe he is conducting. Observers say that a real national front is needed to confront obstacles posed by Hezbollah while getting Lebanon on track to start needed economic and political reforms. For VOA from Amman, Del Gavlak reports.
Lebanese judge Tarek Bitar has faced pushback from powerful Lebanese factions trying to stop his investigation into the August 4, 2020 Beirut port blast, one of the biggest non-nuclear explosions in history. Reports said a huge quantity of ammonium nitrate, commonly used to make fertilizer or bombs, was left unsafely stored there for years. Three former ministers of Interior, Finance, and Transport are defendants in the case and allied to Hezbollah, the country's power broker. They tried to get Bitar removed from the probe as he has sought to question them. Hezbollah's chief, Hassan Nasrallah, accused Bitar of being politicized, despite having a position that is considered neutral. Hezbollah's security officer, Wafiq Safa, warned the judge that if the group did not like his legal work, he would be removed. He would be the second judge dismissed. Political analyst Dania Khaliat Khatib with the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut told VOA why she believes Hezbollah is threatening Bitar.
Hezbollah always tries to intimidate because probably he's going to unveil something they don't want him to unveil. That's why they're trying to block him. Did they store the nitrate? Did they not store it? But, you know, the fact that they told him to stop and they sent him this message, that shows that they really feel threatened by the investigation.
Another former Interior Minister, Ahmed Fafat, told the Saudi Arab News Daily that Hezbollah's actions suggest it is afraid of the developments taking place. Hezbollah accuses all those who disagree with it of treason, while it admits that it receives its orders and money from Iran, Fafat said. He said that unless a real national front is established to confront the party, the country will fall under Iranian occupation. Many Lebanese, especially families of the more than 200 blast victims, are furious that no senior official has been accountable for the tragedy more than a year on. Analyst Dania Khaliat Khatib.
The position of Bitar is important because the Lebanese people are so demoralized. When I saw the parents of people who died 4th of August, someone who was speaking in their name, he said, though we don't believe in the government, but the judiciary had showed us, despite everything, justice can still emerge. And this is very important. This is where the international community, the EU, the US, should support someone like Bitar, should make sure that he's not subject to political pressure, and should send a very strong message, not only to Hezbollah, to anyone. anyone, that if anyone touches him, they will be subject to very strong punishment.
The probe has been the subject of international criticism. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have accused Lebanese authorities of brazen obstruction of justice and of callous disregard for victims' families as the probe drags on. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
And as the financial crisis deepens in Lebanon, pharmacies lack the basic drugs, while over 600 of them have been closed down. And now the Lebanese rely largely on their relatives in the diaspora to obtain vital medication. George Eid reports for VOA from Beirut.
Medical distributors and pharmacies in Lebanon are experiencing a shortage of basic drugs and medications. Most of the medicine cannot be produced or made available locally. For now, many in the country are depending on the diaspora community to send them even the basic medicines like paracetamol. Lebanese expatriates working overseas have stepped in and started sending parcels of medicine to their friends and families. Peggy Bedoyan, a Lebanese expat living in Los Angeles, has managed to send parcels of medicine via friends from the U.S. to Lebanon.
We are a group of Lebanese expats in California. The group is called Cali for Leb. We already had contact with families that were in dire need of help when the economic crisis started. Those families lately had requests for medication. They weren't being able to afford them, or they weren't being able to have access to them. What we did is we took those needs or requests, whatever we could send from the States, we send in suitcases with Lebanese expats traveling to Lebanon. 25 suitcases were sent.
In the United Arab Emirates, home to thousands of Lebanese, the national airlines declared that it will allow free excess baggage for those traveling to Lebanon as a gesture of support for the Lebanese people. Elizabeth Boussamra, a Lebanese expat who lives in Dubai, says she sends medicine frequently to family and friends in Lebanon.
I had to send 3 months worth of diabetes medication for my mother, and I'm constantly sending essential medications to my parents like paracetamol and fusidine, because in Lebanon there is a big lack of medicines and pharmacies are not selling all the products. Even essential medications are in short supply. Antibiotics, for example, are nowhere to be found.
The head of the pharmacist syndicate, Ghassan Al-Amin, explains that the situation in Lebanon is quite difficult and most chronic diseases medicine are not available in pharmacies.
He says the Lebanese government is unable to subsidize the chronic disease medicines anymore. This is why some of them are not available in the market or in the pharmacies anymore. Some basic medicines are not available anymore in the pharmacies, while others are available at very high prices. People are unable to buy them sometimes.
The WHO Director General had mentioned 2 weeks ago that 600 pharmacies in Lebanon have closed down due to the economic crisis that started in 2019. This is George Aid reporting for VOA from Beirut.
The Philippines has started its election season as they are now accepting candidates for national and local positions. Since October 1st, the Philippines Commission on Elections recorded 41 candidates for the presidential position. But the U.S. is warning the Philippines government to watch out for a tsunami of disinformation that could threaten both the conduct of the polls and Philippine democracy in general. Reporter Stanley Buenafe Gajete has more from Manila in the Philippines.
Since October 1, the Philippines Commission on Elections accepted certificates of candidacy of 41 candidates for presidential position, 9 for vice president, 63 candidates for senators, and 125 party list nominees. The voters' registration was extended until October 30 due to the number of Filipinos who were not able to register because of the COVID-19 pandemic. With less than 7 months before the 2022 elections, the United States government is warning the Filipinos of a possible tsunami of disinformation and the pandemic dampening voter enthusiasm, which could possibly threaten both the conduct of the polls and the Philippine democracy in general. John Groch, incoming public affairs chief of the U.S. Embassy in Manila, said in a press conference that the democracy is called into question with informed voting undermined by disinformation and voters potentially opting out because they are afraid for their own health. But the democracy should not be compromised.
These are challenging times for elections worldwide, not just in the Philippines, but across the world and particularly across democratic societies. In his inaugural address, which some of you may have seen, President Biden talked about democracy as being precious and fragile. And he's right. All over the world, including in both of our countries, both the Philippines and the U.S., long-standing commitments to democracy are being challenged by appeals to authoritarianism. So that it's not just candidates who are running in elections, but it's actually democracy itself.
For Grotch, those challenges to democracy are actually being abetted by deliberate attempts to undermine not just the truth, but in fact, deliberate attempts to undermine our very ability to ascertain what is true.
Disinformation that traffics in lies and discredits those who tell the truth, including scientists, academics, and, yes, journalists.
But Grotch explained that through correct and transparent reporting, media outlets could help stabilize the democratic system.
Recent survey results released by Senate Majority Leader Zubiri showed that only 35% of Filipinos are going to be willing to cast their ballots if COVID-19 cases remain high in their community. That's not a great recipe for democracy. And this is where the media comes in. Because journalists play a crucial role in ensuring the conduct of safe and credible elections. That's where the media's responsibility to inform and educate citizens becomes so important.
Grotch, using his lens, said it's important to empower the media to accurately and freely report on election-related issues because elections are a hallmark of a democratic process.
Democracy cannot succeed unless those who express their choice are prepared to choose wisely. It's vital to equip journalists through programs like this and others so that we can have a positive impact on the voting public.
For VOA News, I am Stanley Buenafegaete in Manila, Philippines.
And in other news, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on the government of Ethiopia to allow its UN representatives continue their work in the country, days after seven UN senior officials were declared persona non grata. The Ethiopian government claimed that the UN leaders were allegedly meddling in its internal affairs. The UN Secretary General said that the expulsion did not follow formal procedures. And the UN and other international organizations operating in the country warned that as many as 7 million people in Tigray, Amhara, and Afar regions are now in need of food assistance and other emergency aid. Guterres told reporters after a rare public exchange with Ethiopia's UN ambassador that it was his duty to defend the honor of the United Nations. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. A recent study suggests that climate change has caused an 87,000 square kilometer per year decrease in Earth's cryosphere, or areas of frozen water, between 1979 and 2016. Rick Pantaleo tells us more in today's Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
The cryosphere are the areas of Earth where water is found in its frozen form. According to the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the cryosphere includes the Greenland and Antarctic continental ice sheets, ice caps, glaciers, areas of snow and permafrost, as well as ice that is found in water. The National Snow and Ice Data Center says that the cryosphere also stores about 69% of Earth's fresh water supply. A new study published in the American Geophysical Union's journal, Earth's Future, suggests that our cryosphere decreased by more than 87,000 square kilometers each year between 1979 and 2016 due to climate change. The study, led by researchers at China's Lanzhou University, also proposes that most of the ice loss took place in the Northern Hemisphere. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Taiwan has asked Australia for help following the increase in recent days of incursions by Chinese jet fighters into Taiwan's air defense identification zone. For more on this, Phil Massa reports from Sydney.
China considers Taiwan to be a breakaway province that will someday rejoin the mainland. However, authorities in Taipei consider the island a sovereign state. Like most other countries, Australia doesn't formally recognise Taiwan's self-declared independence. However, there are important bilateral economic and social ties. Taiwan's Foreign Minister Joseph Wu this week urged Australia to increase intelligence sharing and security cooperation as Beijing intensified its military presence in Taiwanese airspace. Australia's spokesperson for the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade said Monday that the resolution of differences over Taiwan and other regional issues must be achieved peacefully, through dialogue and without the threat or use of force or coercion. The statement echoes concern from the US State Department, which also said it was very concerned by Beijing's pressure on Taiwan. Richard McGregor is a senior fellow for East Asia at the Lowy Institute, a Sydney-based research and policy organisation. McGregor told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that Canberra could be drawn into mounting tensions over Taiwan after China sent dozens of fighter jets and bombers into its airspace.
It's psychological pressure, you know, to wear Taiwan down. I mean, China does not want to invade Taiwan. They don't want to fight a war over Taiwan. They want to put enough pressure on Taiwan that eventually Taiwan kind of gives up and agrees to terms, as it were.
Last month, Australia and the United States announced plans to strengthen ties with Taiwan, describing it as a leading democracy and a critical partner for both countries. Due to escalating tensions, such partnership is now critical, McGregor says.
It's going to become a more difficult position for Australia because, of course, if the US decides that it will up its support for Taiwan, it wants help from countries like Australia and Japan.
Australia also signed a new security partnership with the United States and Britain to share defence technologies in what analysts said was an effort to counter the potential threat from China in the Indo-Pacific region. China is Australia's biggest trading partner, but the relationship has become increasingly fraught in recent years because of various geopolitical, diplomatic and trade disputes. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Officials from Cameroon, Chad, Niger and Nigeria have agreed to work together to reconstruct the Lake Chad Basin. The region has been a hotbed of insecurity due to attacks from Islamist terrorist group Boko Haram and its offshoots. The officials met in Cameroon's capital this week and said that the area is gradually returning to normalcy, but unemployment is pushing young people to join militant groups. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
Close to 400 representatives of rights groups, funding agencies, United Nations agencies, and the African Union met in Yaounde to map out ways of improving living conditions in the troubled Lake Chad Basin. In a statement, governors from the region said member states and funding agencies will intensify rebuilding and stabilization efforts of the area. Ahuna Eziakowa is UN Assistant Secretary General and the Regional Director for Africa at the UN Development Programme. She says many of the towns and villages in the Lake Chad Basin need to be rebuilt from the ground up.
Houses have been destroyed. Schools have become non-functional. Markets, stalls destroyed. The rule of law completely erased, with police stations completely destroyed. So a stabilization program tries to rebuild the livelihoods and lives of people who have been affected by, first of all, making sure we reconstruct those facilities that serve the police, for instance.
Since the death of Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau earlier this year, thousands of the group's fighters have defected or surrendered, according to regional governments and officials of the Multinational Joint Task Force, MNGTF, a regional military alliance fighting the Boko Haram insurgency. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day ahead.